So, as many of you know, and some of you perhaps don't know, on Wednesday nights up in Gainesville, where we have a sitting group once a week, and have some period of silence, often a talk, and then some inquiry, some exchange, I sometimes feel it's fitting, appropriate to ask folks after we sit for a bit if there's a theme or an area of interest, area of concern, area of focus that they'd like to address. I'd like to do that now, here. If anyone has something in particular that you are wanting to bring forth, bring out, we'll see if we can weave it into tonight's talk.
The energy of love.
The energy of love. Okay. That's a big one. Anything else?
What does right livelihood mean?
It can be anything. John.
Personal responsibility. Personal choice. What is that?
Okay. Personal responsibility. Maybe one more?
Spiritual narcissism.
Spiritual narcissism. I mean, I've been making sure I get all these. Okay. So, what we begin to see as we actually sit into this moment being any moment, and we sit in and we open, really open to it, we begin to see that there are beliefs and views and assumptions that have somehow formulated that arise about what freedom is or might be and what bondage is or might be. What each of these might be. And I say the word might be, that's very important. And then we set about attempting to overcome the bondage once that assumption, belief, or view is mobilized. We set about attempting to release or relieve or overcome the bondage and realize the freedom. And this is a very common experience. It takes a number of different forms. In fact, many different forms for many different people. But these views, these beliefs, these assumptions about bondage and about freedom pivot around, powerfully I might say, pivot around the notion of a substantial self that is either bound or free or somewhere in between. Okay? Just look at today's unfoldings. And the relative, you could say, bondage and or freedom and the movement or this pendulum swinging between. Now what's this pivoting around? It's pivoting around some notion, view, belief that there's someone, a substantial self, to whom this is happening, that's either moving in an area of bondage or is somehow moving in an area of freedom. And however this is set up, however this is demarcated, okay, one often finds that's not quite enough just like that, but there's often a very clear and tangible preference for the area that's perceived to be related to freedom, and a dispreference or disinclination towards the area that appears to be about bondage. Just for a second. Less than a second. Not assuming either freedom or bondage. Not assuming a self. Not measuring anything that's here in any way by any yardstick. What remains? What's here? Immediate, tangible. If there's no assumption of freedom, nor of bondage, no assumption of someone who is either free or bound, no assumption, no measurement of anything by any yardstick, what's here? When the filter between what's being experienced and what is preferred falls away, what's left? What remains? What gets revealed in the meditation is this assumptive tendency is a conditioned reflex, similar to the reflex that causes the knee and leg to go like this when it's hit in that place just below the patella. And have you ever noticed when someone does that to you how difficult it is to not have that knee go out, not have that leg go out? It just happens. But what's here when this assumptive view, this assumptive tendency of a substantial self falls away? What's remaining? What's here?
Energy.
Could say the energy of love. What we discover is that we don't go poof and vanish. Nothing fundamentally bad happens. And in other words, exploring and discovering the actual nature of realization, it's completely a natural event. Yet the conditioned mind can say quite the opposite. This falling away of familiarity, this falling away of assumption, view, belief, investment, conditioning, is a dangerous event. And yet, isn't it interesting how that very assumptive, conditioned, and at times contracted self wants relief? It wants out of itself? It wants relief, release? And yet somehow, ironically, it fears its own demise. Funny thing is, it doesn't even know what it's fearing. It just paints this tiger called the unknown and then reacts. In the falling away of this assumptive tendency, this view pivoting around a so-called substantive self that's either bound or free or somewhere in between, as this loosens, you don't become a zombie and can't function in the conventional world. Now, if you try to tell some people about this at work, there could be some confusion that you'd have to sort of figure out how to relate to. Unless you, you know, work with people who do this kind of thing too with their spare time on the weekends, or happen to have been a monk or a nun in a previous life or earlier in this life they're in. And then they say, oh yes. And maybe they do one of these. Or they just give you a hug. Sometimes when you allow the energy of truth, the energy of love, you can get away with hugging perfect strangers. And they'll just let it happen, and they'll even enjoy it, and they'll even get into it with you. In a way, everybody wants out of the self-made prison. And we've created, we've erected these social environments. This is a certain kind of social environment of a particularly nonverbal type for the most part, where we agree upon certain things, we get comfortable with certain ideas and feelings and beliefs, and at times it's doctrine, and at times it's even fundamentalist doctrine. And we're cozy together. For a while. I've been mentioning, I don't know why, thinking about him, I don't know why, it just comes up, this George Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff was a Russian individual born of Russian ancestry, and he received these teachings from the ancient Sufis in the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where we know what's happening right now, in part. And he received these teachings and he began to teach. And he had a community in Europe. And people lived at the community. And there was one fellow who came to the community who was absolutely obnoxious. Absolutely obnoxious. He was so, so upsetting to everybody. And the community banded together and they went to George and they said, this is a major problem. This individual is completely nuts. He must be removed. We demand it. And George's response was quite interesting. He said, you must understand, he's the only one on the payroll. I pay him to be here. All the rest of you pay me. And of course, some of the upset dissipated right there, but of course the teachings was in motion. This man was teaching them where they were not able to love. Where they were closed, where they were contracted, where they were afraid, where they were reactive, where they were judgmental. He's the only one on the payroll, he said. All the rest of you pay me to live here. Pay for rent and food. Actually, what's happening as realization dawns is that what you thought, believed and assumed was real or true about who or what you are simply comes into question. I'm not so sure. As the perception of familiarity starts to go like this, starts to slide a little, I'm not so sure. Of course, if you really looked honestly, you never were too sure, even before that. But there's been an assumption that, you know, I'm kind of sure about this or that. Now this shifting, okay, this wobble, this loosening of assumptive perception, belief, and view, it's not an intellectual questioning that emerges, but it's an opening, it's a shift in perspective. An energetic adjustment. Consider that, okay? If you've ever had your body adjusted with the massage or the chiropractic type things that we have in our world, just consider this to be an energetic adjustment in the area of who you think you are. and the Dharma is going. And it's giving you that little... And sometimes it feels like a thrust adjustment. You know, in chiropractic medicine, they have the thrust adjustment where the bone's out of place and they thrust the bone back in. And sometimes the adjustments are more subtle. I've seen some of you leaning during the sittings. Okay? And I don't mean so much from sleepiness, but this energy starts to move the body like this and like this, and the head's going like this. We're going to get into this a little bit tomorrow. We do have some time to explore not just the release from outer movement, but the release from inner movement. Okay, so we're sitting there and the head then, you know, we don't even necessarily know it, but if we took a picture of you at the beginning of the sitting, you were like this. You were as much Buddha as you could be, statue. And then at the end of the sitting, you were like this. Or you were like this. You know. And you were trying to go with it. Yes, you were. You were trying to go with it, probably. Trying to go with what was happening. Let it happen. Okay, there's a way to let it all happen, and this doesn't move at all. Outwardly, nor inwardly. We'll clarify that tomorrow. Now this shift, this perspective adjustment, this energetic adjustment, as it begins to happen, sometimes fear arises. There can be a closing down around this, a tightening up, and it comes up spontaneously. This starts to tighten, this starts to tighten, this starts to tighten. And one recognizes this is fear that's happening now. Fear is arising. And sometimes that adjustment gets shut down. That's why there's chiropractors still. It's a very evolving thing, but there's chiropractors who still try to sneak up on their so-called patients when the patient's not really, like, watching. They'll, like, be telling them a joke. Hey, you hear about that? It's pretty barbaric, actually, you know, because we need to think about, like, why is the bone out of place in the first place? How about that? And, you know, if we thrust it back in, you know, maybe it doesn't like that. You know, maybe we could find a gentler way. And that's evolving as well. So when the fear arises, things seem to shut down, they close down. But let's say for the moment that fear doesn't arise. Then the adjustment, the release from conditioned perception feels good. There's happiness that arises spontaneously there. Because there's relief. There's relief. There's the third noble truth. There's the cessation, to some extent, of the investment, the assumption and the investment in a substantial separate self that no one can put their finger on and find, but yet it's proclaimed nonetheless. So it feels very good as that begins to shift, that begins to loosen. What happens in one sense is that nothing really changes. And yet the one who was experiencing life shifts. Still having sensations, still having breathing, still having sounds, still having thoughts, still having memories, still having planning, still having fantasy. And yet the one, so to speak, who's experiencing that shifts. And this is how the first noble truth and the second noble truth are revealed. The first noble truth's basis is in the assumption, view, belief in a substantial separate self. Does that mean the talk's over? Oh, it's time to wake up. It's the new morning bell. Did anyone's mind say, that's not supposed to happen here?
Yes.
It did. See, it didn't care what you thought. It had no consideration. The Dharma is not like that. The Dharma is not without any consideration. The Dharma has your most heartfelt, central, deep, deep interest fully in hand. It's already in place. That's how, in a certain sense, right or perfect the teachings are. The notions that we have, the ideas that we have of perfection, are almost always conditioned by that which we see as less than perfect. Something other. The Dharma has nothing to do with that. The Dharma is completely beyond the concepts we have about good, bad, perfect, less than, and all of that scaling that we do. I'm going to have to include this in the talk. It's included itself. So there was a retreat going on one time that I attended over in England. I used to go over to England to do these retreats. I just like England. South England, beautiful country, pastoral, rolling. Beautiful meditation center out in the middle of this countryside. So quiet, you'd open your window because there weren't any bugs. Weren't any mosquitoes. Open the window. The silence was just so broad, so deep. It just used to lay there in my bed, close my eyes. Four other guys in the room with me. And they'd be snoring away because it was a communal bedroom. Snoring away. You know how those guys do, snoring away. Some of the women too, but these guys were snoring away, and the silence was completely beyond the snoring. It was so wonderful. Teachings were wonderful. Food was skimpy. They didn't have much money. You know. Iceberg lettuce, no dressing, and none of these accoutrements here. If you look around in there, there's different things appearing. A little of this is a little of that. You can even find some flaxseed on a good day. Flaxseed, you know, cucumbers. You probably haven't hit it all yet. I haven't got anywhere near it myself. It's a little much. Iceberg lettuce, no dressing. And it was only a small few leaves. I noticed that all the notes that were being passed at the end of the retreat, they were all notes that had been used before and crossed off, or on the other side of the piece of paper there was something, you know, had been typed out by a computer. It was all kind of recycled. You know how, for me at least, enjoyable it was to get so simple and realize, in part, the affliction of need. The affliction of the perception of I need this and I need that. Anyways, so the teachings are flowing along nicely. We're up to about the sixth day, maybe. It's like 8-day retreat. All of a sudden, during the Dharma talk, an alarm did not go off of the kind that we had, whatever that was. A different kind of alarm went off. All of a sudden, a woman came into the sitting hall. She hadn't been at the retreat. She just kind of burst in. And there were some staff members around her, and they sat down. She sat into the room with everybody else with the staff members around her. And there was this... Do you know from the Peanuts cartoon, there was the character Pigpen? Now, Pigpen moved, and there was always this stuff around Pigpen. Okay? It was like that, energetically. It was just like... And this sort of agitation just appeared. And the talk went on. And the teacher opened up at the end of the talk for some questions. And this woman began to speak. And as she began to speak, it became clear that she was highly agitated, that she had been in a situation where the social service agencies took away her child because she was not competent, they deemed, to care for this child. And she relayed other things very quickly. They just kind of flowed out of her. It was kind of chaotic. on. If anybody was thinking there's something else supposed to be going on here, then they were missing the teaching on the energy of love. Because what actually happened was the group opened up. And the energy in the whole room began to change, and this woman settled down. She stopped moving around her arms so much, and she settled down, she got quieter, and she started to meditate with us. Meanwhile, the staff members were sitting around her in a circle. There was like four of them, like sentries. They were like watching her. They were holding her. And I turned and I looked at this. And it was a teaching on the energy of love. It's quite moving. In an old house, so old that the floors went like this. No, that's not your perception changing there, Paul. The floor is actually going like this. One of the walls in the house was from the 1400s. An outer wall, stone wall. From the 1400s, that wall was still erect. And other parts of the house had been built around that. But outside my dorm room, the floor went like this. Nice waves of wood. I'm laying in my bed that night and fall asleep. Suddenly I wake and I hear this woman's voice again, and she's screaming now. She's screaming about how could they take her child away. And there's footsteps. And again, I imagine here comes the staff members. They come out of their rooms. I imagine them getting in a circle around her again and caring for her. And her voice slowly settled back down. Next morning in the Dharma hall, she was sitting, eyes closed, meditating with everyone else. There were no more outbursts. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody that was disturbed in this world could come into a place like that or a place like this and receive that? She came in so broken and lost, it seemed, so out of control, so traumatized. And in short order, things began to transform. You could put theory as to why, but I'll go at it. And I'll say my experience was it's the energy of love. Love has a power that opens up life, lightens things up. It's beautiful. But the lightening up, the unloading that happens, the relief that occurs when the assumption of a separate self comes into question, that energetic adjustment is so huge. Everything, all of life, lightens up when the perception of separation is pierced. Nothing can be taken so seriously anymore. Nothing can be taken so seriously because nothing can be taken so personally. In quite the same way, until there's nothing at all to take personally. Not one iota of it. And maybe that's where unconditional love lives, is in none of it's personal. What opens up is the realization that you don't need to be somebody. You don't need to be someone. You don't need to be working on being someone. You're being already whatever's happening. One moment life's like this, the next moment life's like that. One moment the meditation center is very quiet, the next moment the doors burst open and something different's happening. And we never know what's going to happen next, do we? We like to think we know, based on some kind of composite of past experiences. We then leapfrog over this beautiful, ever-changing, dynamic, alive present. And we generate an idea of how it might be later. Go a little bit out, go a long ways out, go a whole lifetime out. All you've done is generate an imagination. What you begin to realize is that there's no need for understanding or analysis that's intellectual. It may or may not happen, but it's not required. And then you begin to see that your original nature that's been forgotten, as it emerges, it's ever so familiar. Yes, I know you. You realize what you've always been. Now, I want to shift out of the common notions of the word responsibility, as sometimes it's conditioned into the mind as a burden, a weight, I must, and even the notion of duty at times weighs people down. I lived in California, I lived in a house in the city of San Francisco, and it was quite close. All the houses touched in this area. There was no space between. So the walls, you could hear people easily. And this Chinese family that lived next to us, he would yell at his children. And he would yell at his children. And he would yell at his children. And sometimes we'd hear the children whimpering. If you went to his door, which I needed to do occasionally, to say hello or to do something, he would do this with the curtain, and he would push it shut, and then he would go back inside. Should the police have been called? Where's the edge in there? My neighbor down below, he lived in a tiny room. It was called an apartment. I don't think it was an apartment. I think it was a closet. Next to the garage that we shared. He was a man who was divorced. His wife was somewhere else. And his children would come and stay with him every other week. He was a cook, making relatively good money, but not enough to have more than a closet to live in, it seemed. And one day, as we were talking, because he was kind of a tight guy, one day we were talking, and he said to me, I just can't wait till these kids are grown up. I just can't wait till my kids are grown up. And I didn't have anything to say that day to that. I didn't know what to say to that. I just listened to that. Here he is, living in this burdensome duty, waiting for it to be over, and letting it out with somebody who I guess he felt safe enough to say how he was feeling. This is not what responsibility is about. Responsibility is about the ability to respond. Like those staff members did with that woman who came in and was kind of going crazy about being separated from her child by the social service agencies in England. We have an idea that there's a personal responsibility. I have responsibility. And yet as the energy of what love really is awakens, not only does that energy itself loosen the perception of a separate I or me who is loving, but it opens up a greater clarity that if you still want to say there's personal responsibility, then go at it, but perhaps if you do, the personal responsibility clarifies into your personal responsibility is to awaken to what you really are. And along the way, live as ethically as you can. Let the numinous nature of being, the indwelling, you could say spirit, and I use that word very sparingly. There's an energy that's in this room that's the numinous. It's a word to describe something that guides this whole dance. That energy combined with the ethics, which means you do the best you can to help life in any way you can, that's responsibility. And you might find it necessary and valuable and compelling to make sense of the apparent mess, not by going in there and analyzing it, and I'm talking the personal mess that you might find, but by just looking at it clearly and letting it reveal its nature. That's what the meditation does. If that's not adequate, and sometimes it's not, you're looking at someone who's done a lot of talk therapy, and I mean as the client, talk about the experience of what it's like to be living. And we know now on planet Earth, we know now, perhaps like never before, that the combination of a safe space to communicate one's experience to a person who won't judge you, who will listen to you and perhaps guide you, combined with meditation, which you in some ways seem to be doing by yourself. Of course, we're actually doing it together with each other, so we're really not alone here. But nobody else seems to be having your thoughts. And you might say, thank goodness. Or you might say, boy, I'd like to have everybody have that thought with me, because that was a real zinger. You know, that I'm proud of that one. I'll have that one again if I can. The combination, the marriage of an honest, mindful communication, a truthful dialogue, blended with the silence and the inquiry. Pretty good chemistry, pretty good combination. Pretty good way to relieve what ails the human. You've got to be careful, though, about putting theoretical constructs on the idea of personal responsibility. Sometimes there's a compelling sense of what one, you might say, must do. The first crack in the egg, there's an image that's sometimes given for the nature of awakening. The human is born like the baby chick still inside the egg. The awakening is when the eggshell cracks and that chick comes out of the egg into the sun. The first crack in that eggshell for this was, interestingly enough, in kindergarten, where we were forced to take a nap one day. And I do mean forced. It wasn't you can, you might. No, it was you will. You will lie down and take a nap now. Now, this one couldn't take a nap. There was no nap for this one. It was barely possible to lay on the side. But since we're in an indoctrinated situation where we're being told what to do, the body ended up on its side, and I remember this very clearly, the right side. It was on the little mat. We all had the little mats. And quite spontaneously and surprisingly, laying there unable to close the eyes even, never mind take a nap, and the windows that ran from ceiling to floor in a semicircle out into the nature. The sun streamed in and touched this, and there was a timeless space of happiness and ease and love, which I wouldn't have even called love. Wouldn't have even called it happiness or ease. Didn't have the language, just the sense of it, that everything was perfectly okay. Now this, you could say, realization or awakening or shift was quickly followed by, okay kids, nap's over. You could call it the interruption of the apparent conditioned world, and thus the experience, for various reasons which I'll never probably know, was buried, completely forgotten. And yet some 12, 13 chronological years later, there was an overwhelming impulse that arose to learn to meditate. I ask you, where could that have come from? Where could that have come from if not the numinous that appeared through the sunshine and the windows and the mat and the connectedness of that moment in kindergarten? The numinous and the ethical, numinous and the right action, numinous and the right livelihood, numinous and non-harming. We are practicing an outer and an inner discipline when we come here. Letting go of speech makes it very difficult to engage in speech that's harmful to ourselves or others. And yet this thing is powerful. I believe it was even Jesus that said, "Be not so concerned with what you put in this, but what comes out." And so the teachings are very clear about that. As much as possible, take care with the words. They're powerful. They influence. Take responsibility. Be caring. This thing is powerful. It can do great things. It can also harm. It's been harmed. It can harm again until the ethical and the numinous are braided deeply enough so that it becomes impossible to hurt. The awareness, the mindfulness, the clarity is a safe guard, safe haven. What people do is they attempt to practice ethics. It's somewhat willful until the practice deepens enough so that it becomes natural. It becomes natural not to harm. It becomes natural to care. I remember being taught loving kindness meditation, which is a meditation that you go into the energy of love towards life, towards specific people, towards yourself eventually, which is sometimes the hardest one to love. Have you noticed? Or that guy in Gurdjieff's spiritual house there, that's the guy that's hard to love. He's you. He's saying hi to you. He's meeting you. He's reminding you what you haven't seen yet, what you haven't accepted. Is something happening that's beyond so-called your responsibility? There's life living itself through us. We can register this at times clearly in the breathing, that the breath is breathing itself. Life is breathing through this. As this becomes clearer at all, you could say, aspects of the empirical, that's the observable, so-called self, it becomes increasingly difficult to harm with physical actions or with voice. And eventually it pares down so that the thoughts, and here we go now into the place in the mind that's judging. The place in the mind that's judging is born from comparison. I asked one of my teachers many years ago, I asked him about comparing mind. I said, what about this comparing mind? Can you talk to me about this comparing mind? And he said, it's one of the last fetters to go. You see, because the comparing mind is born from the tendency to split the world up, to ignore the fundamental unicity of life, to ignore that, to somehow be blinded to that fact, and therefore to divide it up subtly or not so subtly. And it's from this place that any and all judgments about self or other arise. You see, the world, the nature, the universe is completely indivisibly connected. Parts can be distinguished, floor from stool or bench or light, yes, but these are just words. It's clear that these things are all, as I like to say, touching one another. They're all touching one another. Every particle. And people work at this next one. They work hard at it sometimes in their thinking and their philosophizing. And that's fine. If you want to do it, then do it. But what I'm pointing to is there is no answer to life's meaning or purpose. Except that life is its own purpose. What's happening is its own meaning. Ascribe anything on top of that that you want. That's your freedom. But it's already expressing its purpose and meaning through how it is. Or you could say the sense of purpose or meaning is within life itself. It's within what's already happening. It doesn't need to be laid on top and then believed upon, agreed upon. Ah, yes, this is life's purpose or meaning. See, and it's interesting because if you hear that in relation to what I said earlier when I said personal responsibility or the responsibility or the birthright that we come to this world with is the possibility of awakening. Let me just describe that as the ability to respond, not responsibility. Just turn it inside, the ability to respond. The newness is wisdom itself. The ethical is compassion. The two wings of the bird of liberation, one wing is wisdom, the other wing compassion. Both wings are necessary for the bird to fly. That's what this is all about. The numinous and the ethical ever intertwined and manifesting as intelligence, as light, and as radiance. This goes past what the humans have erected as morality. It goes past that. It goes into a place that's pure intelligence, pure light, pure radiance. If you look closely, it becomes so clear that any lack of fulfillment is exactly consistent with beliefs about self or life. And again, these beliefs about self or life often take the form of beliefs about freedom and bondage. Beliefs about freedom and bondage. What constitutes each? Beliefs about self, life, or anything are completely arbitrary. They're completely subjective. They're completely reflexively conditioned into the mind, and they're ultimately totally unnecessary. One of the biggies in this bundle that I've just described is the belief or assumption that we or life needs to be different in order for fulfillment and happiness to happen. The only thing that needs to shift for fulfillment and happiness to come forth is this, you could call it aggregate or grouping, that generates a perception or belief or view that you are not okay just the way you are. That you are not free, that you are bound, that you somehow must be different, that you must do this or do that, or not do this or not do that to be happy. Now granted, if you're acting out and you don't understand the nature of ahimsa, of unharming, non-harming, if you don't understand that, those actions will have consequences. But once the true metta arises, not as a practice that you do from your mind, but an organic flow like a flower that emerges right up through the heart, that's the true metta or loving kindness. It's not done from the mind, it happens spontaneously. And sometimes your heart needs to be broken, you need to go through something radical and deep and sometimes very painful before it's realized the spontaneous nature of compassion. But in the meantime, it's okay to practice it if you want to and work on it through your thoughts and ideas. That's fine. So again, one of the biggies is the belief or assumption that we or life somehow needs to be different in order for fulfillment and happiness to happen. This is an illusion. What we appear to be is constantly changing. I hope that's somewhat clearer today than it was yesterday. And yet the idea of fulfillment and happiness about being different, needing to be different, again, is an illusion that must be and will be pierced. Until it is, it will operate. And it will push you towards this or that or not this or that. It will move life around. Unless, of course, you become disinterested in the possibility of fulfillment and happiness, then I would say, what are you interested in? And sometimes people are interested in the welfare of other beings. Why are they interested in the welfare of other beings? Because they want other beings to be happy and fulfilled. And if other beings are happy and fulfilled, then they will be happy and fulfilled along with them. It's sympathetic joy. I mean, what else are human beings doing unless they're making a mess of this world? And there seems to be some of that going on. Even in the name of trying to stop the war. The wars. When this illusory idea that you must be different or life must be different in order for fulfillment and happiness to emerge, when this is not present, when this conditioning perception is no longer there, then what comes clear is that happiness and fulfillment are the nature of what you are. And when life isn't clouded, and even when it is, it's still shining forth behind the clouds. Not because it was just born, but rather because it was uncovered and now it's visible. That's where therapy and meditation are very much the same. They're both uncovering processes. It was covered by the false idea and belief that you have to be different. There's the blanket. You have to be different. We're not here to see just what we appear to be. We're here to see what we actually are. And to see what you actually are, in many situations, for many so-called people, requires that you see what you are not. You see what you appear to be. And you look through those mirrors, those lenses, those appearances, those filters. That's what this meditation's have been about, largely, is looking at. That's why it doesn't always feel good, too, to look at these filters, to look at these cloudy lenses, to look at this confused, deluded, illusory mind. And it sometimes is hard and difficult. And yet that bell rings, and you come back in here, and you draw on the energy of love that's in this room. Because there's an energy of love that's coming forth to the best that it can through each of these body-mind processes, and sometimes you partake of that. You might not so readily come back into this room. If you knew when you came back into this room, everyone else would not be here, and it would just be you. You could still take the one seat. Take that one seat, keep taking that one seat until you realize you can never be separate from anything or anyone, even when you sit completely alone in a physical space. The man who was considered the second Buddha after Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, was a man named Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna's discourses were so clear that many felt he was the second Buddha. Nagarjuna's teachings in six words. Since all is empty, all is possible. Since all is empty, all is possible. Nothing has autonomous existence. That's what he's saying. Because nothing has autonomous existence. The nature, the truth, the reality is complete unicity, complete whole interconnectedness, no separation. Even the idea that you're a separate human being sitting over there, sitting over there, sitting over there, sitting over here, wherever, that idea is deeply embedded in the unicity of the all, even as it thinks it isn't. You could say there's no escape. Or, as Pema Chodron once wrote, it's the wisdom of no escape. Wrote a whole book on that, the wisdom of no escape. Since all is empty, all is possible. Empty of separateness. Empty of separateness. All is possible. And so, to whatever extent it's realized that what is called the self is a constant changing process of elements and factors and conditionings. There are four categories that this breaks down into very, very powerfully and clearly, and we've been practicing these to some extent in our days here. This is the heart of meditation as it was taught by the Buddha. It is called the Satipatthana Sutta, or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's a large teaching, but I'm going to just touch upon it. The first foundation of mindfulness, the first foundation of awareness, is the body and the breathing. Knowing the in-breath as in-breath, knowing the out-breath as out-breath, knowing the in-breath as transitory, ephemeral, impermanent, knowing the out-breath as transitory, ephemeral, impermanent. Body, meaning bodily sensations, movements of body, the postures of body, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, knowing these clearly, knowing body as body, knowing body as sensation. Arising and vanishing in all aspects, breathing and body, feeling, pleasant as pleasant, unpleasant as unpleasant, neutral as neutral, arising and vanishing, no solidity, no self in feeling. Contemplation of mind, mind states, particularly in this area, knowing the wanting mind as wanting mind, knowing not wanting as not wanting, that's aversion, and knowing deluded mind as deluded. Knowing these things as transitory and impermanent, without self. Contemplation of mind objects, fourth foundation. This is the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the seven factors of awakening, and the Four Noble Truths. The five hindrances, already in part covered, through the wanting and not wanting tendency of mind, there's two of them. The third has been experienced at least by one of you today, sloth and torpor, sleepiness, heaviness, restlessness. Have you seen it? Restlessness. Fourth hindrance. Fifth hindrance, doubt. Doubting the teachings, doubting the teacher, doubting oneself, doubting life, doubting the Dharma, doubting, doubting. Doubting. The five aggregates, again, overlaps here: body, feeling, perception, mental activity, and consciousness. Knowing these five aggregates as not self, no separation, arising and passing, elements of body, four great elements, earth, water, fire, and air. These four elements are what allow us to know the sensations as what they are. That's what this body is the four great elements. And of course, the fifth being space itself or the ether. Sensations of weight, heaviness, there's earth. Sensations of cohesion or dispersion, there's water. Sensations of temperature, there's fire. Sensations of lightness, vibration, tingling, there's air. Look at any sensation and you'll see these great elements unfolding. Again, feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling. Very important area to know, very important aggregate to see clearly. These feelings deeply condition until they're seen clearly. They deeply condition the tendency to crave or have aversion, craving the pleasant, having aversion to the unpleasant. We've talked a bit in the groups today about perception, the lens, that view, the way something is seen. These are conditioned into the mind. There's a perception that would say to you, this is a carpet. Of course, there's a concept there too. This is a carpet. Notice how difficult it is to see this as other than carpet. Notice how difficult it is to see this as something other than book. It is perception that allows that to happen. Perception of orange or apple or banana. Perception of body. Perception of thought. The way things are seen is through the action or faculty of perception. There's no self in perception. There's no I or me in perception. Perception is just something that arises and passes. Again, mental formations, thoughts, mind states, and emotions, a very important aggregate to see clearly. Nothing solid there, nothing possessible. Just like everything else, arising and passing by nature. And then consciousness. Oftentimes we think there's a consciousness that's solid and continuous. It's disproved immediately and fundamentally and radically when contemplating what happens in deep sleep. There's a complete deep dreamless sleep, complete forgetfulness of all of this, and there's absolutely no problem. What happened to consciousness? We think of consciousness as continuous between the various objects that are arising. This isn't true. There's a different consciousness for the eyes, for the ears, for the tongue, for the nose, for the body, for the thought. It's happening very, very fast. The Buddha gave a mathematical equation for this once. It had all kinds of zeros after the one. How quickly it's happening. So consciousness is the fifth aggregate. No solidity, no permanent abiding self there. The six sense bases, the eyes, the nose, the tongue, the ears, the body. What we know is the so-called outer world is only known through the senses. Consider that right now. What we call the outer world is only known through the senses, primarily the sense of sight and the sense of hearing. Notice the sense of taste, however it's appearing right now. It seems to be happening inside this body. It seems to be in a world in here. And yet if we take food and put it on the tongue, then we've taken something from the so-called outer world and put it in the inner world, and then there's taste. And where do thoughts arise? You see, because thought, the mind itself, is the sixth sense base. It's actually a sense base. What are thoughts? They are energy that's sensed. Thoughts are actually more a feeling than anything else. There's a feeling that's there. There's a sense that's there of thoughts. One of my teachers once said, all thoughts are sensation. That was very confusing for a while because I really thought they weren't sensation. They were thoughts. I believed in my thoughts as thoughts. They're not sensations. Sensations are body. Thoughts are mind. It's completely arbitrary and subjectively split up. Then we have the seven factors of awakening. We've been exploring, cultivating mindfulness, investigation, right energy. At times a bit of joy can come. If we kept sitting, that factor of joy at times would get stronger and more powerful. Joy without object. Joy born simply from the power of interest and investigation and awareness. Joy that needs no excitation to arise. Very subtle joy. It's called piti in the Buddhist Pali language. Tranquility, concentration, equanimity. All of these factors have been working, assisting, helping. Again, no self in these factors. No I or me. They're just factors that arise and pass based on certain conditions. And then the penultimate, you could say, big, big cherry on the cake, the Four Noble Truths. This is the Wheel of Dharma. The Wheel of Dharma appeared in this world through the historical Buddha and his offering. And the Wheel of Dharma was inserted into the Wheel of Samsara so that the world of delusion and illusion and separation and misunderstanding and suffering could be penetrated and relieved. That's what it's all about. It's all about relief. So the first noble truth is that there is suffering. There is suffering. Life is unreliable. Anything could happen at any time. People think there is no cause. Actually, there is cause. there's deep causation behind all in the relative world. It's not haphazard, it's not random. Some people say it's good fortune or luck. Why did I have to, beyond anything else that I could possibly be interested in, why did I have to learn to meditate when there was no one around to learn it from? It was overwhelmingly compelling. The mind simply just went there and would not give up. The wheel of Dharma appears in so many different ways, but the Four Noble Truths was what the Buddha first taught. And who did he teach it to? He taught it to his companions who had abandoned him when he stopped the ascetic practices of self-mortification. They felt he'd lost his composure, he'd lost his balance, he'd lost his way. No, he hadn't. What he discovered was that abuse, that mortification, was not the right way. It was not the middle way. And so he abandoned them, or rather they abandoned him. You could read it either way. And he went on his way. And finally, under the Bodhi tree, he sat. And he sat with that same stillness, that same composure and commitment. Imagine that if I said to you, okay, at the end of this talk, we will sit as if we're under the Bodhi tree, and there will be no movements until full emancipation appears. We're going all night. There'll be no bell. It's terrifying consideration, or some people will go, yeah, I'm in. Second noble truth is there's a cause for the suffering. What is the cause? The cause is ignorance. It manifests as craving and clinging. Of course, this ignorance must be centered around the sense of there's an I or me that's ignorant. See, it all starts to come unpacked when it's realized there's no one who's having these experiences. There's no one who is ignorant. Ignoring can happen, the tendency can arise, but it's not happening to anyone. See, because as the mind gets a hold of these first two truths, it says, now I will work on understanding suffering and its cause and its release. I will do this. Meanwhile, it is the suffering itself. That I or me that thinks it is going to undo suffering is the suffering itself. And so the way that suffering gets relieved is not by the end of unpleasant sensation or conflicted states of mind. The way that suffering ends is when there's a falling away of someone who's having these experiences. Should I say that again? Suffering doesn't end through the unpleasant sensations going away and conflicted states of mind ending. Suffering ends when the perception of an I or me who's having those experiences falls away. And there's nothing you can do about that, because the one who's trying to do something about that is the one who's making the mess. It's like a Mobius strip of conditioning. You know what a Mobius strip is? It's like the strip with a twist and it's connected. Supposedly the DNA in the body is constructed like that. It's a Mobius strip of conditioning of self-perception, of I or me, to whom these things are happening. It's relatively easy to say, okay, but we're sitting here practicing so that this becomes realized. Because no concept will do the trick. Somebody could repeat it over and over to themselves. There is no self, there is no self, there is no self. I remember a fellow came into a retreat once. He gave a talk, and his energy wasn't quite right with the group. There were people who he'd had small group meetings with, but they didn't really like him. I didn't hear of any brawls or anything like that, but some stuff was coming up for people, some projections and whatnot. And I think he was struggling, actually, myself, when I spent a little time with him. Anyways, he got up in front of the group and he started proclaiming, there is no self, there is no self, in different ways. And it didn't sound too bad, but as he kept saying it, people in the group were getting more and more agitated. You know, they're getting more and more upset listening to him saying it, because it didn't feel real. It felt like just a platitude, a spiritual sort of, you know, mantra. There's no self. This is so simple, you know. The little baby that came into my therapy office the other week or so ago, he's just at 7 months and he's just getting it together to get up on the toes and do a little of this and a little of that. And he's just like looking and connecting, and just like he'd go up on his toes and then he'd look. And then he'd do it again and he'd look. Okay. And he's just completely being. No self-consciousness. That moment's immediate and available right now. We are that little guy on our toes for the first time, second time, third time. The third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the falling away of ignorance, the falling away of illusion, the falling away of delusion, the falling away of the idea and the perception, belief that you are a separate person who is suffering, or who can become free. It's the falling away of this idea that brings the liberation from bondage and suffering. That's exactly how it works. And the fourth noble truth, the way, the path, the sensible, scientific, rational, emotionally balanced life, the Eightfold Path. Threefold training is the Eightfold Path. Threefold training, the outer discipline, the inner discipline, and the punya, or the wisdom that comes from the marriage of the two. The outer discipline, right livelihood, right action, right speech. Straightforward, common sense. Don't harm with the actions. Don't harm life, others with the livelihood. Speak with care. Speak the truth. Try not to gossip. And if you do and must, have a really... No, never mind. And then the inner discipline. There's the meditation, the right energy, the right concentration, which is the present moment object, the right mindfulness. Mindfulness opens up into this space that I was describing in the sitting this afternoon. The choiceless awareness. Okay, prior to that, one thinks one's guiding the mindfulness and making it happen like this and following it like that. And there's nobody there doing that. There's just an energy or an intention or an impulse that thinks it's making these things happen. This choiceless awareness opens up. It becomes very clear, yeah, what the freedom or liberating nature of mindfulness really is. The word mindfulness and awareness mean the same thing. Now, there are different kinds of awarenesses. There's the naked awareness or original awareness that the Tibetans speak about. There's an awareness that's beyond the mindfulness of the objects. Okay. So these, you have to be careful about these words, consciousness, awareness, and different meanings that people ascribe to these things. Okay. Find out for yourself. Find out for yourself what the word points to in your own direct experience. Take no one else's word for it. Because if you do, you're just putting more concepts in your mind about what the truth might be. And eventually those things are going to go poof and fly away anyways. So why collect them? They don't really help. But the mind sometimes will grab onto something and get a definition of something, and it'll just hold it for a while because it feels right. Feels right. Let me check that out, though. Let me really check that out. Is that what that really means? Inquire into those things. So all of these contemplations that I'm mentioning, of the four foundations, all the way through, lead to the culmination in the Eightfold Path, which is right view, correct understanding. Okay, mostly what we're doing here is we're penetrating through what would be considered deluded perception, or sometimes it's called wrong view, and seeing into right view. Now, right view means many different things, but the one I want to mention is that nothing need be different than it is. Everything is as it is. Nothing need be added. Nothing need be taken away. There's nothing right nor wrong with anything. There's nothing to get away from, and there's nothing to get. Life is as it is, moment to moment, and there is no one who is experiencing all of this that's separate from all of it. That, in short, is right view. So ethical living, meditation, assist in the awakening of this punya. Punya is the Pali Buddhist word for wisdom. And as this wisdom dawns along the way, spontaneously, for some people more than others, whether they practice it or not, love, compassion arises. It arises spontaneously. And if you like to, you can do meditations that help you practice it. Now, as these practices are engaged in, if the self-absorbing or narcissistic tendency of mind is not considered, not looked at, one starts to feel that one is getting enlightened. I am getting enlightened. I am getting free. I am getting powerful. And these are powerful things. These are the most powerful things we can actually access as human beings, the truth itself, realization. And so sometimes the personality structures inside certain people where they will start to become spiritual materialists. They will turn spirituality into something that I called last night the achievement mentality, the gain, the maximizing the gain, minimizing the loss. It can get very, very severe. There are a number of stories. If you look at the stories of Eastern teachers who've come to the West, and you look at them, not so much during their life, but you look out at what comes out after their life. Many of them were crossing sexual boundaries. Many of them were violating the boundaries that need to be there for care and respect with their students. It gets so bad one time with the successor to Trungpa Rinpoche, a man named Osel Tenzin. Osel Tenzin was given the light or the transmission of Dharma in that tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Trungpa Rinpoche was one of the first Tibetan lamas to come to the West. Osel Tenzin had AIDS. Osel Tenzin was sleeping with his students. Osel Tenzin passed AIDS to his students. When finally confronted on this, he said, "I am the Tulkul." Tulkul means the Lama. "I am the Tulkul." Complete spiritual narcissism, complete ignorance operating. And at the same time, isn't it unbelievably, mysteriously true that the Dharma holds it all? The Dharma holds it all. The truth of profound suffering unfolding through a being believing, "I am the Tulkul, I can pass this disease to you." He knew, as far as the story goes, as it's been told to me, he knew what he was doing. Some people would put the label of evil on that. And then we debate sometimes, does that actually exist? I'll go straight at it as best as I can. There are evil actions. There are actions that are quite harmful to life itself, born from the same things that generate suffering for anyone to any degree, and that is ignorance. Not seeing the truth, not understanding things the way they really are. So the honest communication, if one feels like one's getting puffed up about it, one feels as if one is getting it together, and, you know, I'm kind of starting to shine. Okay, of course, there's a sense of insecurity almost always underneath that. A sense of insecurity and unworthiness. Some kind of woundedness that hasn't been revealed yet that causes one to think one is somehow better. That very teacher who gave the transmission to Osel Tenzin, Trungpa Rinpoche, wrote a great book, classic, many of you may know it, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's a classic in its time, and it's still very brilliant in what it has to say. If the mind, in its narcissistic, egotistic tendencies, self-centered tendencies, gets a hold of something that's very powerful, and sometimes you'll see teachers that they're teaching because they love the adoration, they love the power. Oddly enough, they love the masochistic sense of being separate and better. Because you see, no one's better than anyone else. No one's higher than anyone else. I mean, really. Even if you're sitting on a chair, you're not higher than the rest of us here. And us lowly ones down on the floor, we're not any lower than you. And you must know this. And it flips around sometimes. People are thinking, oh, I'm not getting this right because I'm sitting in a chair. I have to sit on the floor. The ones on the floor, I've heard people over the years, I have to sit on the floor. I must sit on the floor. That's the way they should do it. And so they grab a hold of this idea once again and force themselves into the floor is where I must be. Even though their knees are killing them. I have to be on the floor because that's the better place to be practicing. No, it's not. Who said so? You can sit in a chair. The Buddha taught mindfulness in four postures: sitting, standing, walking, lying down. So as these contemplations, that's what they are, they're contemplations, as they deepen and clarify what's really going on here, not what we think is going on. The story we carry in our mind about where we come from and what we have done before begins to lose its pull, it begins to lose its magnetism, its attraction. It simply falls into a lighter place. And if occasion arises or conditions arise and someone says to you, hey, what happened when you were 13 or 14? Your mind may be able to go back and remember it. But it becomes less and less important, that story of who you are historically. So much that arises initially is born from the past accumulation. What's called the samskaric or samsaric storehouse. And as this loosens more and more and more, then naturally happiness and a certain ethical carefreeness arises. When I say carefree, I don't mean careless. I mean carefree in the sense of non-compulsed, non-pressurized. And then perhaps you can run down the meditation hall like my teacher did, and when asked about it, simply say, I needed to run fast. I wasn't unmindful. See, I thought he was being unmindful. How dare you be unmindful and tell me to do six-part walking, which is what he just said to me to do. Four-part walking, you need six-part walking. So we become less and less capable of worrying. And that's a wonderful thing, because as the Navajo Indian little Joe, 4'11", once said, worrying is praying for what you don't want. Worry, anxiety about life, about oneself, can consume the mind at times. Worrying, checking, am I okay? Sometimes the first waking moment in the morning is, am I okay? Am I okay? Is life okay? Will I be okay in the future? What's coming next? How do I prepare? What do I need to do? On so many people's minds right now in the USA, financial markets cracking in half and hemorrhaging, people are spending so much time, what do we need to do? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? All about survival, isn't it? It's all about survival. And as you were saying, John, it's all about, in a certain sense, clinging to existence. You see, the clinging goes in three different directions, so to speak, or takes three different shapes. One clinging is the clinging to sense pleasures. As that thins through, it begins to become clear that there's two others, this clinging to existence. And this generates, of course, fear of death. Because the existence that one is clinging to is my existence. This is my existence, and I want to continue to exist. Can't find the I, but I'm going to cling to and to exist anyways. And then the third, clinging to non-existence. These are people who want to die. These are people who fall into a space where they want to, or they think about suicide. They want to end the existence, to try to end the misery. Now, on the other side of that, they believe or they think that they will be happy or relieved. And this is really rolling the dice, wouldn't you say? Because there's no way to know that. Now, if you take the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddhist teachings, which to me are the most precise teachings about liberation ever written out that I've ever heard of, rational, pragmatic, scientific, the intellectual mind can understand them, but they only operate when they're experienced directly. And so there's this whole cosmology of the multiplicity of lives, transmigration through eons of time. And what is it that passes from life to life, so to speak? Well, a simple image is given that I think is very, very apropos, and very compelling. There's the force of becoming, the force of volitional activities that moves, like the ink that moves from the stamper on the postmaster's stamp, from the pad that acquires the ink over to the letter. Nothing of the stamp is actually transmitted, except somehow through the ink there is an impression that moves. This is an image or an analogy that describes what actually continues from so-called one life to the next. It doesn't make any sense to believe in this unless you want to. It's not necessary. You don't need to refute past or future lives unless you can do it directly, experientially, nor why refute them? Why say they don't exist or they exist? Why not live in the openness to find out? See for yourself. If you can feel the power of becoming, if you can feel the power of volitional activity, it doesn't take too much more contemplation to consider the possibility that that very energy probably won't just go poof and disappear into a sort of nihilistic nothingness. Like some people believe deep sleep will be what happens at death. Whenever I talk to people who hold that belief, they're often very, very uninvestigating in their experience. They just stick that in there. And if you can get them to talk a little more, sometimes they live with a certain anxiety that they might be wrong. And so too sometimes the anxiety of the person who presupposes and assumes they're going to some heavenly realm, like my dear old dad. He believes he's going to a banquet and we'll all be attending. And he says, you'll be there too. And I say to him, well, if I am there, just make sure when I ask for a second glass of milk that I can have it. Because when I was a little kid, I asked for a second glass of milk and you said no. Do you remember that? It happened. So he gets relief, he does. He gets relief. He feels satisfied in his belief that it's going to be a heavenly banquet and everybody that matters is going to be there. It's a construct of the mind. And why take that away from someone, you know, and force them to investigate the fact that they don't know what they're talking about? Especially when they're 90. It's all about survival. Am I going to be okay? Will I continue to be? And if it's not worry or anxiety about the present or the future, it can simply be, again, this force of becoming through the action of thought, through the movement of thought. Just look at those thoughts appearing, disappearing. Where are they coming from? When you look back there, you can't find any place they're coming from. They're coming out of nowhere, and they're dissolving into nowhere. And what might be wanted or what might be hoped for that's generated through the thinking. The contemplation reveals that there's nothing wrong with this thinking. Nothing wrong with this thinking. There's nothing wrong with anything. There's nothing wrong with anything. But this kind of thinking is utterly and completely unnecessary. Just as all beliefs are. It really signifies nothing. It's not relevant whatsoever, except that it's revealing the nature of all things if it's seen clearly, and that is the nature of impermanence. It points to nothing but its own cyclical Mobius strip. Seeing through this means it can dissolve, it can fall forth, it can decentralize. It's the same thing with the concept of self. When it's seen clearly, it just decentralizes. I'd like to conclude this talk with a teaching And this teaching came just recently. The good thing I would say in preface to this final sharing here tonight on this is that initially you think the Dharma starts to come in through one or two of the pores of life. Okay? Just think of life as a multi-porous being. In fact, countless pores. Initially, the Dharma seems to come through one or more of those pores, like the Dharma appears in the form of a written book. The Dharma appears through some kind of connection with another person. The Dharma appears when someone gives you a CD. Dharma appears in a certain way. Eventually, what becomes clear is that the Dharma can appear at any time through anything. And eventually, what happens is it's seen that the Dharma is the only thing that's happening. It's appearing as everything continually. The teachings are ever present in and through all things. And so, in my own experience, the years of involvement in this have revealed this more and more clearly, that things just appear, and it's the way of seeing them that opens the Dharma eye. Prior to that, they could just be newspaper clippings or something that doesn't really even register as all that significant. But I don't think you'll have any difficulty at all feeling the significance of this immediacy and total, clear and succinct proclamation of the Dharma. This is from a woman named Willa Cather. Willa Cather, I see some heads nodding, American author who grew up in Nebraska, quite poor, and needed, you could say, from a deep Dharmic place to get a further higher education. And so a lot she did to acquire the funds to be able to go to school. And she became a great American author. Let me quote her. She says, "I was entirely happy." Perhaps we feel like that when we die and become part of something entire. Whether it is the sun and air, or goodness and knowledge. At any rate, that is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great. What Willa's describing is awakening. And I am fairly confident she knew nothing of Vipassana meditation. She's describing awakening. She's suggesting it might be like this when one dies. But this is actually what's happening in the meditation. Awakening, the apparent you, the substantial separate self, is dying. Actually, it never existed. There's just an idea that it's there. You can't find it. And as it falls away, as it dissolves, as it thins, the real you emerges. Complete, whole, and free. May all beings realize the marriage of the numinous and the ethical. May all beings experience direct connection with the power of love. May all beings see through the illusion of a separate, substantial self. We could sit for a minute or two together.